And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985. The station obtains a cable license, bringing CJSF to a wider audience. And we've been changing the sound of radio in Burnaby ever since.
Speak up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
The Museum of Vancouver has opened three new exhibitions and has recently renovated gallery space, exhibition space, museum space down along the shores of False Creek in the same location as the planetarium is. The three exhibitions that opened just last month are The Work of Repair, Redress and Repatriation at the Museum of Vancouver, an exhibition examining those issues in relation to Indigenous objects and Indigenous communities and sharing those objects and information and so much more. Another one is Future Makers, in which the gallery, or the museum rather, collaborated with Kwantlen University and a program there, a design program there, to take some rescued and recycled marine mahogany and to have students create chairs examining the history of that work and the history, the connections to what's going on in society, colonialism, whatnot, coming up with some really, really fascinating pieces that you can see down there in the gallery. And those ones are worth going to take a look because there's some really unique pieces, and most of them are going to be available for sale via an online auction. And the last one is Deep-Seated Histories, Chairs from the Collection. And it is an exhibition of over 150 chairs in so many different styles from Vancouver's history, showing some from famous theaters, showing the way design and home decor changed over the years. Some of them have connections to famous individuals such as Joe Fortes, and others. And I had a chance to talk to curator Denise Fong, who's the curator of urban studies and lead curator for this exhibition. And this is our discussion. So we're standing at the entrance to the Deep-Seated Histories exhibition, which is a new exhibition here at the Museum of Vancouver. Tell me a bit about it.
So the title of the show, Deep-Seated Histories, Chairs from the Collection, is a focus on the Museum of Vancouver's permanent collection of chairs and other forms of seating. We've been around for over a century. The Art Historical and Scientific Association started in 1894, and we've been collecting things about Vancouver since then. So we have a pretty substantial collection of chairs, and they in total amount to around 250 pieces, and we selected about 150, right, including chairs, dollhouse miniatures, and other forms of seating. So it kind of gives visitors a chance to look at the evolution of chair design, mm-hmm, looking at the form, the materials, but also to delve into the history behind each chair, because when we did the curation process, we looked at, you know, what are the stories we can tell through each individual chair. Sometimes it's tied to famous people, it's tied to heritage sites and important moments in Vancouver history, businesses and like theaters and places like that, that really we hope will resonate with visitors when they come and see them.
So what are some of the pieces that sort of in that category that we'll find here?
Yeah, so we have this piece right here close to the entrance. It's the Joe Fortes Morris chair. And there's been new research published about Joe Fortes' history, and we're very fortunate to have a piece that came from his home. And we also did some restoration work. So when we received the chair, it actually didn't have any cushioning on it. So we did conservation treatment and added some seats so you can see the full form of it. And we also have photograph of Joe Fortes in front of his home, which is where the chair came from. So there are stories and historical photographs to add life to each chair that's on display. We have some pieces here. For instance, this one is one of the oldest chairs in our collection, the Barclay chair. It's dated to 1787.
Oh, wow.
So it's in really wonderful condition considering its life. And also we have a lot of stories here that talk about life in BC before Vancouver was incorporated. So it gives people kind of an overview of Vancouver history, but contextualized within the history of BC's founding. So if you move into the galleries, you'll be able to see along the walls video screens that tell stories about the process of curating the show. So a lot of behind the scenes shots that you can see, like what do museum workers do day to day? We also have spotlight interviews and features that talk about specific chairs. So for instance, we have an interview about the Little Sisters bookstore, and we have the stool from the bookstore that's in the collection. And so it helps us to really delve into how kind of how Vancouver has changed over the years in terms of immigration and diversity. We look at topics such as environmental sustainability. We're also interested in urban issues and also looking at redress and decolonization. So all these themes are kind of interwoven into the way we've curated the chairs for the show.
Excellent. It's quite a range of items here. Would some of these have been made locally back in the day?
We do have quite a few that were locally made. And this that would be in our second gallery where we feature some of the mid-century modern chairs that we have in the collection. If you walk through the show, you'll be able to see the change in the form and the materials that are used, especially with the more contemporary chairs. You see there's a lighter form, smaller footprint. There's more diversity of materials. You see metal, you see plastic, you see bent wood, steel, like lots of different materials being used. So these are our cluster that's made in Vancouver. So we had a pretty substantial furniture producing and selling industry in Vancouver, and we invited expert Alan Collier. He's a researcher, very knowledgeable about craft history and design history in Canada. So he contributed a short essay and also an interview to share about his perspectives and provide kind of an overview of design history in Canada through the perspective of the chairs in our collection. We worked with a civic historian, Mr. John Atkin, and he helped to also interpret some of the seating we have, because we have seats that are associated with theaters in Vancouver, heritage buildings, and different other locations that have like a memory in Vancouver residents. So
I've seen this cluster here, a whole bunch of different Vancouver-based manufacturers that were working around the mid-century.
That's right. Yeah. So a lot of the stories are captured here. You can pull out one of our little booklets here and you'll be able to read the stories behind, you know, the history of how we acquired the chair and a little bit about the company itself.
And then over here you have a big neon sign representing one of those companies.
Exactly. So in our collection, we acquired a piece from Brooks Corning Furniture Company, this little oak chair. And because also MOV has a wonderful collection of neons, we decided to spotlight one of the neon signs from Brooks Corning. And this company's been around since 1913. And we also, through our collaboration with students from Simon Fraser University, were able to conduct an interview with Bob Ross, the CEO of the company. And so,
This particular company is still going.
It is still going. So we're really proud to have like a Vancouver focus in the show and be able to show some of the historical photos alongside the chairs is also, I think, going to be a very enriching experience for our visitors.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Fascinating bit of Vancouver history here.
Yeah. Thanks for visiting.
And that was my discussion with Denise Fong, curator of urban cultures and the lead curator for this exhibition, The Deep-Seated Histories, chairs from the collection of the Museum of Vancouver. Really interesting exhibition. You can check that one out and the other two new exhibitions happening down there, the Future Makers, featuring a bunch of specifically created chairs made out of mahogany, beautiful works of art, and The Work of Repair, examining redress and repatriation at the Museum of Vancouver. All three fascinating ones. Hope you can go check them out. And thanks. We'll be back in just a moment with more of Speak Up.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
I was see through too much and take strolls downtown. Thinking it's a garden of shame. You take the night train and live to see another day.
The family of seabirds called alcids is an eclectic bunch, including the comically colorful puffins and dashingly tuxedoed murres. The largest alcids are about the size of a duck, but the smallest, called the least auklet, is no bigger than a sparrow. Barely 6 inches tall, the least auklet could fit in the palm of your hand. It has a black back and white belly that turns a splotchy gray during the breeding season, when it also sports attractive ornaments like white facial plumes and a little bitty upright horn on its beak. Leased auklets flock together, often by the hundreds or thousands. Short wings whirring, the miniature alcids look like swarms of feathered bumblebees. They dive below the ocean's surface to gobble up teeny crustaceans. In the summer, leased auklets form massive breeding colonies on rocky islands of the North Pacific Ocean and Bering Sea. In August, when the young birds are ready to take their first flight, millions of auklets scatter to the winds across the northern seas. But scientists still don't know precisely where leased auklets ride the winter waves till spring. A big mystery for a tiny bird. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
All right, welcome to Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our resident gardening expert. And you're here every week with us talking about gardening and passing on tips and education. But that's also what you do as your full-time job, which is, of course, why we wanted to talk to you in the first place. why don't you just tell us, because you have the gardens program as part of Embark, one of the streams you're doing, which of course means that there are other ways to learn about gardening besides listening to this podcast.
Correct. Hi, everyone. Good morning. As you mentioned, gardening is my full-time job. Every day I do gardening. And with Embark, we focus very much in our two gardens that we have in campus, one in the Student Union and one in at Southside of Task One. So Embark itself has two strings of focus. One is the climate equity, and the other is the food justice. And within food justice, we have gardening, developing gardening skills and knowledge. And so anyone that has some gardening skills is welcome to join us. Anyone who just is interested in knowing how to start with growing vegetables as well is welcome to join us. So we run four gardening cohorts during the year. We try to match each gardening cohort with the season. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, we just are finishing with our first summer cohort, and we are doing a call for our second summer cohort that will start on July the 10th.
Right. So if someone joins one of these cohorts, how does it work?
Yeah, so we meet for every Thursdays between 11 and 12:30. We have moved 1 hour forward our regular meeting time from 11 to 12:30. And during that 1.5 hours, you as a participant will have the opportunity to get hands-on. So we start each session, we start with a 30 minutes sharing garden experiences. For instance, if we are talking about garden planning, how to make a nursery, how to transplant, which methods of gardening we have, the square foot gardening, how the planting distances, companion planting, intercropping, and all those agricultural techniques. So we share with that, and later everyone goes and start tending their own plot. Because as a member of the garden cohort, you will get one garden plot, 4 feet by 4 feet, for you to practice what we are sharing. So if there is not any crops that need to be harvested, well, you apply the harvesting techniques. If there is an empty space in the plot, you will go and plant. We provide all the plant material, seeds, seedlings, bulbs, anything that is needed in order for you to really start practicing, becoming more confident in the time to do gardening. I think that's one of the things that everyone is concerned, like, I'm doing right. Is this the right thing to do? and of course, through those activities, we start learning as well. For instance, don't put the seeds too deep. Make sure that there is enough space between plants. And sometimes there is a plant that we would like to relocate. So as well, we share how to do that. Because sometimes you say, like, oh, the plant is going to die if I move from here to there. But if you're doing the right way, the plant will suffer a bit, but it will recover after a few days.
Mm-hmm. And that working together is so valuable, especially for people who are relatively new, because, of course, there's all the sort of follow the directions stuff you can do to learn any task, including gardening. But then, as you say, there's a bit where you get where, oh, there's like, I'm not sure what's happening here, or should I do this or that? And having yourself as a resource, but of course the other people in the cohort to help you look at a situation and understand really what's going on is a super valuable learning experience.
Yes, that's right. So because we are a learning community, so everybody shares their perspectives and supports or challenge your idea in doing the gardening. One thing that we make very clear at the beginning is there is no right way of gardening. Mm-hmm. So there is no right way of gardening. There are different perspectives and different ways to do gardening. So that brings down the anxiety, like, ooh, I'm not a green thumb, but you can become a green thumb because there is no right way of gardening.
Yeah.
And then with the community, with the cohort community, yes, there is this building a community, sharing experiences. And there are people with members of the participants that have a bit more experiences. So mm-hmm. they as well become a leader and they become a sharing their experiences. So yeah, it is quite a sharing space. The other thing that we very much encourage is that do not expect to have supermarket standards of the crops. Mm-hmm. If we grow carrots, fantastic. We manage to grow carrots, but we should not expect to have a supermarket standard. Yeah. We are happy to have a carrot. Even if it's a tiny one, we are happy because we are learning. Mm-hmm. And sometimes happens that we are weeding and suddenly the carrots go flying like, oh, why are you pulling the carrots? Oh, I didn't realize they were the carrots. So, as well. So it's a learning environment, and we are not focused on production. We are focused on learning. And if the produce comes and grows, it's great. Well, we are happy to have those.
I think this, you know, working in that environment, because, you know, one thing about gardening, of course, is it's time-based. It sort of works on a kind of cycle of activity, which is relatively long in the sense that, so if you're trying to, you know, if you're just on your own starting a plot and learning and making mistakes, sometimes, you know, when you do make a mistake and things don't work out, maybe it's all the way to the next year before you get a chance to try it differently or put to work what you learned. Whereas in this environment with the cohort, you know, you're going to be able to identify your mistakes or the better way to do something much earlier than if you're on your own and
correct, you know, yes,
and correct yeah. things and get good success within your cycle instead of getting through your cycle and go, oh, well, this worked, this didn't, I'll try better next year. So it's really going to accelerate your learning from what you might be able to do on your own, no matter how much books and videos you're watching.
That's right. Yes. So having the space and having the community, the support of the community, and encourage everyone to learn and to realize, like, well, yes, I did wrong this time, but the next time I will do better. Yes. And if you're going to do it by your own, you will say, oh, I did wrong, and you just stop. You just say, oh, it doesn't grow, and I don't try anymore. Well, yeah. But we try, and so, and besides, the having the students have their own gardening plot, we also have additional gardening plots that need maintenance. Yeah. So if your gardening plot is all fully planted, nothing to do, we move to another garden, to another space where we can continue practicing. Yeah. So that is the advantage to have the learning gardens in that we do with Embark. So mm-hmm. we keep moving, and always there is things to do.
Typically, how many people are in one of your cohorts?
So usually we have around 10 people because that is the capacity that we have. We can't be the best to accommodate 12 people, but just 10 people. And as well, when we invited participants, we make sure that they are committed. Yeah. Unfortunately, gardening is a commitment. It's a personal commitment. Plants don't water themselves. So somebody needs to come and water the plants. Plants don't harvest themselves. So when a plant needs to be harvested, we need to do so. Otherwise, nature will do it for us. So if it's not nature, it's the garden visitors. They say, oh, that vegetable has been there for 2 weeks already and nobody's harvesting. Well, bistros will do it for us. So that is where we encourage everyone. So we, over the years, we have come with a commitment that if less than 50% of the participants don't show up for two consecutive weeks, we just simply